thank you so much for coming back on with us. How are you handling it during these interesting times?
I wouldn't say well, but given what others are going through, you have to put it in perspective. And we're very lucky and very blessed to have family together and to be relatively safe and to be able to be fed and housed. Not everybody in America or in the world is certainly able to have the basics being taken care of. And neither am I on the front lines putting my life on the line every day. So relative to the, to what's happening out there, I can't complain.
I'm interested in your perspective on what we see happening out there with people demanding that the country reopen, even though most states haven't even met the incredibly minimal standards established by the Trump administration. Is that really do you think it's a sizable number of people, or is it an incredibly vocal minority that seems to be getting an undue amount of coverage?
Undue amount of coverage is a key idea here. Trump instigates a violent and loud reactions from a small number of people, and the press is still, I'm sure, enjoying their greatest ratings in decades. And any way that they can stoke the fire, I think they will go ahead and do that. So there was one picture of a demonstration early on in Michigan, I think it was, where a bird's eye view showed 100 people, and you can get a demonstration of 100 people that is not as interesting, that won't get covered by the press. So yeah, I think it's undue coverage, but I certainly understand people legitimately are afraid of not putting food on the table. But this idea of liberating Michigan and liberating states that where governors have been critical of Trump is mind-boggling, as is almost everything that comes out of the administration, including putting a muffle on the CDC and altering surveys, changing the CDC yesterday removed a survey out of Washington. It was a Washington university where they were using a model of projected deaths, which was favorable to Trump's vision of what's going to happen. Those projections were altered for the worse by a huge amount, great degree, yesterday because of the lack of proper mitigation, and the CDC removed the survey from their website. So we're living in the times are scary enough without having a person in charge who is seems to be intent on destruction as vast and as wide as possible. His only motive, if you read his books, is vengeance, and his only capability is to destroy, and that's who we have running the show. It's very dire in my view. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm just wondering how do we get to this point in America? I guess what I'm talking about especially is the denial of facts. And that didn't begin with Trump. He certainly used that as a boost to his popularity. But where did we get this notion in America that science doesn't matter anymore and that facts are open to interpretation?
Well, I've been reading some history about all this, apparently this idea that you can bend the truth in favor of the propaganda you want to disseminate, is not new. It's old as a country barn. It's I think it was first talked about on a great scale in the 1920s, and Walter Lippmann was a reporter back then who wrote about how the masses in a democracy. That's at a time when everything was getting big. Industry was growing out of proportion. Population was growing, was expanding at a scary rate in the 1920s. And he wrote a piece where, you know, that the masses were capable of being swayed by propaganda. And you had William Randolph Hearst, who was the first to use yellow journalism and lies and propaganda, and was actually bent on fascism back then. And as you move towards the Hitler's takeover in Germany and the Nazis and other dictators around the world in the 20s and 30s, and mostly in the 30s, you see the use of propaganda. You know, Goebbels in Germany, the propaganda machine of the Steve Bannons and the Steve Millers and Jared Kushners is right out of the Goebbels playbook. It's right out of how to become a dictator. You know, Germany was one of the great democracies in the world, and great social progressive places of culture and learning and freedom in the world. And look what it turned into in the 1930s. So, you know, I always wondered growing up, being born 10 years after World War II, 10 years after the atrocities of the Holocaust were uncovered. You know, how the world could have, how a country, how a people could lend themselves to that kind of horror. And never understood it. But now I get it. I totally get it. People are easily swayed. And when people are on a mass level are feel jilted or betrayed, as I think they have from the Democratic Party over decades, not all the fault of good-intentioned Democratic leaders and presidents, but because of a obstructional Congress and a mixed government. You know, the only time we've ever had real progress in this country in terms of freedoms and civil rights and equality in culture and in society, less of a disparity of wealth and all and such, is only when we've had a unified Congress and a unified president. So that happened during the New Deal in the 1930s, and that happened briefly in the 1960s with LBJ and the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act and so on. And the Republicans have brilliantly figured out how to use propaganda and steal the ill Democratic South and use religion and use guns and use abortion and all of these issues to divide and split and conquer. And what's fascinating in reading the history is that, you know, Nixon, Reagan were equal rights, equal ERA supporters of family planning, if not actual abortion. You know, Planned Parenthood was something that Republicans could get behind back in the 60s. Somebody figured out if we divide America, we could take this country, and the GOP has done a brilliant job of doing that. And this monstrosity in the office is something that they're not only willing to accept, because people assume that they're Republicans in Congress are afraid of Trump and his retribution. I don't buy that for a second. I think they're very quietly and happily supporting getting neoconservative judges, incompetent or not, in the courts, and creating a greater disparity of wealth than we've ever seen in our history. So it's not a happy picture from what I'm reading.
We're talking with Richard Schiff here on Downtown. Well, let's focus on something a little bit happier. You and your wife, Sheila Kelly, doing something that looks very fun, has had a great early response. Are you going back to the very beginning of The West Wing and watching those episodes? And is it right that this is the first time you've watched all the episodes?
It's the first time I've seen a lot of them. You know, but Josh Molina and Rishi, his partner, have created West Wing Weekly, which was every week they watched a new episode and talked about it and had guests on. And I was a guest on that probably 7, 8, or 9 times. And so I watched shows to prepare for, you know, my visit on their podcast. But and I've seen a few here and there. But yeah, for the most part, I've not seen very many of the West Wing. So we started as an idea, as a way, because people have asked, and as a way to kind of take our minds off things. And apparently on Twitter, a number of frontline workers find these sessions to be a nice respite from the real world. So we're doing it. It's not as fun and as easy as I thought, because I have to watch myself and go through all those emotional moments, from the time of acting in these shows, but also, I'm reliving kind of the time of shooting The West Wing, and while many of those memories are great and fun, there are some that aren't so great. So it's kind of interesting to relive it, and I really should write it all down. But in the meantime, we're doing we tried to do one a night, but that's been a little problematic. We're having trouble with our internet here because everyone's home using their internet, so our internet is a little weak. But overall, it's been a lot of fun, and getting the family together. My kids have never seen, haven't seen very many shows either. My wife, Sheila, hasn't seen them all, so it's kind of fun. We're enjoying it, and it's interesting to see people's reactions to issues that, are still relevant today, and the way that fictional White House at the very least, try to do the right thing,
Well, it's good to see a functioning White House and government, but more than that, the idea that you've got people on both sides trying to do what's best for the people, and that's something that, to me, is the greatest thing we've lost in the last few years.
What's fascinating is that you see just the first few shows, you're seeing stuff like the gun bill and the episode Five Votes Down, which is the early show, about how they were... The West Wing, the Bartlet administration, was bent upon getting that bill passed, despite a writer that was attached to it, the strip mine in Montana, which got them all in a huff. And in the end, you realize that the bill is not going to do anything. It's just that they needed a victory. And when you think about it, it's a very realistic portrayal of how difficult it is to govern, and especially in a split Congress, because the Bartlet presidency had a Republican House. And the reality that, compromise is your best bet, and any progress is incremental and not sweeping, And just the first few episodes, it reminded me of how accurate Aaron Sorkin was in depicting a realistic administration, which, at its best, loses a lot. Think about their greatest accomplishment. It was getting Mendoza, the Hispanic, on the Supreme Court. What else did they really do?
Right.
They didn't solve India-Pakistan. They didn't create peace in the Middle East. Disparity of wealth was worse. It still got worse as they want. So... But it's very soothing to see people who actually want to leave the world a better place than how they found it, despite their failures. And that's what I think is so rewarding about it.
I've watched countless times most of the episodes, and the ensemble is so incredible. We know the writing is great, but I have to say there's a special magic when you and John Spencer are in a scene together.
Aw, well, that's very sweet. I've been... so appreciating watching John's work, which I absolutely adored in the doing of it years ago. I always cherished our scenes together because we would literally forget who was on camera, and we had cameras. It was almost like being on stage with him. And so committed was he, and he absolutely loved every second of acting and acting on that show in particular. He and Martin adored each other. He was so supportive and so loving and so great. and demanding when we were, you know, when he was on set. So thank you for that. I take that as a huge compliment because he was such an artist and such a great actor.
I know you're a big baseball guy. Are you missing it a lot right now?
Somebody tweeted today that they put their dog in a Red Sox uniform so he could boo them. He could boo his dog. And I tweeted back, send your dog over to my neighborhood so I can partake. I do miss it. Every year I tape every game. And I'll even if I have to speed through it, I'll watch every pitch. I love the how an entire season unfolds. You know, I love that it's a marathon and that things change as teams get healthy and or get hot and all that stuff. It's like each season is an epic novel, you know. And I really miss spending my afternoons with the Yankees on while I do my work in my office. Yeah.
Do you remember the first game you went to as a kid?
Of course, it was Ted Williams.
Oh wow!
I think it was either 60 or 61. I was 5 years old, and my grandfather, who was an old Brooklyn Dodger fan, took me to Yankee Stadium. There was no Dodgers. The Dodgers had left. The Mets hadn't been born yet. Giants had left. And as much as my grandfather hated the Yankees, he turned me into a Yankee fan because there was no other team in town. And so we went to that game. I don't remember it much, but I do remember 1962 being taken to Game 5 of the World Series against the Giants. Mm. And I remember seeing it to this day. My father lifted me up as Tom Tresh hit a 3-run home run in the bottom of the 8th inning into the right field seats. And the Yankees won that game and also won the series. That was the first game I remember. Yeah.
Who was your favorite player as a kid?
Well, you know, you had to go with the Mick. Mickey Mantle, we all limped in the playgrounds to imitate him. You know, I caught the back half of his career after he was hurt and maybe had a couple of good years left. But I did see his 500th home run live on May 14th, 1967, which made me cry as he limped around the bases. Mm. He also went 2-for-4 that day. He had a single to center as well. But I also love the utility players. You know, I love guys like Hector Lopez. And over the years, you know, the guys that that got an opportunity and made the best of it. Was it Brian Doyle? Remember in 1970?
Yes.
Willie Randolph got hurt, and he took over second base. He was Denny Doyle's brother. Denny Doyle was on the Red Sox. And didn't do much else. But he hit like 400 in that World Series, and by rights, you know, Bucky Dent, I think that's the MVP, but I think by rights, it should have been Brian Doyle. I don't know if Dent, who got the MVP, medals or Dent? Maybe it's Bucky Dent, but Brian Doyle had a phenomenal series filling in that moment, and that was the highlight of his career. And I always loved those guys that were able, Phil Lynn's of the early 60s, Mm. Well, I later played softball. He had a bar in the bar league in New York, and I played. My team played against him. Joe Pepitone was on his team, and I remember. And I was a pretty good third baseman. I made a stop of a ball to my right, playing third, and rolled over after snaring the grounder down the line. I popped up and threw a chest high bullet to first. And Phil Lynn's goes, he's, you know, right there in the bleachers. I did it right in front of him. And he goes, nice play, third. And I said to him, I learned watching you, Phil. And a big smile came on his face. And that's a memory that I'll always have.
Well, that's great. You mentioned that.
I made a Yankee smile.
What? That 67 season, I think it was the first game I went to. You know, here in New England, was at Fenway Park, but the Red Sox were playing the Yankees, and it was Mickey's next to last season, and I remember watching him hit a ground ball to short, and he only got about halfway down the first baseline and just rounded off and headed for the dugout because, you know, the knees were so bad even then. I wish I'd seen him in those early days back in the 50s when he was, I think, along with Mays, the greatest player in the game.
Yeah, Well, you know, I think only Tim Raines has been timed from home to first from the left-hand side faster than Mantle. And he was the fastest in baseball back then, home to first, plus majors from the right side. And, and he could have stolen 40 bases a year if he wanted to. I think years later when Bonds or somebody, Bobby Bonds, somebody had made it to 30 home runs, 30 stolen base, and Mantle said, if I knew that was a big deal, I could have stolen 50. But he was super fast and incredibly powerful. You know, no one, back in the old days, people forget that the stadiums were so much bigger. And so straightaway center field was 461 feet in Yankee Stadium with a 17-foot high fence. And only one player ever hit the ball over the center field fence for a home run in Yankee Stadium. And he did it twice, and that was Mickey Mantle. Not even Babe Ruth. All the great power hitters, Harmon Killebrew, who played in the American League, no one hit it over the center field fence except Mantle. And it needed to go 500 feet to clear that 17-foot fence. You know, so the power that he had, and I always wonder, you know, what if he had played in Atlanta where Hank Aaron piled up all those home runs, or even in the current Yankee Stadium. Can you imagine? Because he had gap power.
Right.
I used to see him hit 450-foot ground rule doubles to left center. You know, I saw him hit a shot over the second baseman's head that ricocheted off the auxiliary scoreboard in right center, which was, by the way, they think it's a short, it was a short fence. It was 407 to right center. Well, it was short to right. It was 407 to right center. Ricocheted off the scoreboard to the center fielder just as he turned around to go get it. And Mantle was held to a single because he hit the ball so hard. You know, he had incredible power. He wasn't a great defender, but he had great power and obviously hit as high as 365 one year. So he had it all, but had it not been for the drinking and for the injuries, yeah. I'd love to see him play in this era with the technology of fitness, you know, and the regimens that these modern athletes have, what he would have accomplished, you know.
Well, hopefully we can get some baseball back at some point. I even checked out some of the Korean Baseball League just to see a little bit of baseball action.
I saw that they opened with no fans, right?
Right.
And you think we're going to do that this summer?
I hope so. I mean, I don't think there'll be fans anywhere in any American ballparks, but I hope they're able to get back. I miss it, and I miss just the diversion to get away from, well, the horrors of everyday life.
It really won't be too hard, too much different than going to Yankee Stadium in the mid to late 1960s and seeing Mantle hit a home run into an empty bleachers. Because there was only 15,000 fans, maybe 18,000 going to games back then. The Yankees were bad. Mantle was old, and baseball was kind of dying there for a minute. Remember back in those
right.
days, the Red Sox were different because they had a great team in '67.
Well, that's right. I grew up. I came of age when the Yankees. You know, I was six when they had won their last World Series in 64. So by the time I was really paying close attention, the Yankees were made up of the Jake Gibbs, the Horace Clarks of the world. And I didn't have the hatred that some of us fellow Red Sox fans have had. And I always liked a lot of the Yankees through the years. You know, Bobby Mercer was somebody I always enjoyed watching play. And Mel Stottlemyre was one of my favorites as a kid.
Stottlemyre was a three-time 20-game winner with a lifetime 297 ERA. He was my favorite. I loved him. And I got to meet him in Dodger Stadium when the Yankees were playing an exhibition game there. And down the left field line, I said, "Yo, Mel, how are you?" He comes over and he gave my son a ball and signed it.
Well, that's great.
Horace Clarke with Jake Gibbs. Yankees didn't win in 64. Cardinals beat him.
Well, that's right. That's right.
Their last one was the one that I saw, 62, because they lost to the Dodgers in 4 and 63, Koufax and Drysdale, and lost in 7 to the Cards, and then were gone. They were done at last place for like 4 or 5 straight years. Horace Clarke, Jake Gibbs, they had a couple of Steve Whitaker, turned out to be a bust. But you guys had Yaz And you had Dewey Evans, right? 67, or did that come later?
67 was Tony Conigliaro, although he got beamed in August and missed the last couple months. But Reggie Smith as a young player, George Scott had a great year.
That's right, George Scott, the first baseman. And you had, what was your catcher?
Catcher was Russ Gibson, primarily. Rotation of catchers there. Well, actually got Elston Howard from the Yankees fairly early in the season.
That was very disturbing. That was the first time I saw a Yankee in a Red Sox uniform. By the way, I never got used to the Red Sox coming to the Yankees. As much as I appreciated, what's his name with the hair? Johnny Damon.
Johnny Damon, yeah.
You know, and by the way, Wade Boggs won a championship with us too. I was like, what's this Red Sox doing in pinstripes? Get him out of here. I didn't want him. I didn't want Damon either.
I love it.
Clemens was another story because Clemens came via Toronto. He didn't come
directly
from Boston. And Boston had given up on him. You know, but of course, they didn't know he was going to be taking steroids.
Well, Richard, it's great to talk with you again and wonderful to talk some baseball, get our mind off the rest of the world. I love what you're doing with the West Wing. You're going to try and start it up again this Friday?
Yeah, we did a session yesterday, and apparently our internet got messed up. And so my son is working on that, and we're hoping we get somebody out here Thursday and we can start up again on Friday. And it's that episode in Excelsis Deo, which people have voted as their favorite West Wing episode, and of course it's the one with the homeless veteran. And I hope to get a special guest on there, and we'll see someone of national notoriety who might be able to join us, and we'll see. And so we're looking forward to it, and people should join us. It's 4 p.m. Pacific time, but they can always catch it via Periscope or Twitter. It stays on Twitter so people can find them and catch up if they want.
That's wonderful. Well, we're looking forward to it. Richard, thanks so much for making time for us this afternoon. Well, we wish you and your family well. Stay safe, and we'll talk again sometime.
Yeah, stay safe. Thank you so much. Same back at you, and it was a pleasure. Take care now.